accession number 23089, rail 4.
Excuse me. Margaret Cornish, Rideout, and this is Reel 4.
Well, the butty again was tied nearest the bank, so we reluctantly took our buckets and filled up, emptied our coal box and took two bucketfuls back to the pile at the where it had been hidden behind below the lock. We never mentioned that we'd also filled the coal box in the motor cabin, so we did have some. And of course, at night time, we dared not light the fire in the daytime because he would have seen the smoke and realized that we had pinched his coal. So we could only light up. That's when we used to go into Leamington during the daytime, and then in the evening come back and cook our meal, such as it was, and light up, and at least we had warmth at night. And I mean, I can remember another time when I had my own boats using coal. It was always a good commodity for bartering, and I had the privilege, of course, of the motor cabin to myself. It was a very doubtful privilege because, of course, you had to cope under the floorboards that you're in the cabin went the shafting. And the shafting, which went from the engine, of course, to turn the propeller at the back end. And there were couplings. There was in segments with kept together with couplings with nuts and bolts, and they were always coming loose. And you had to make sure. I used to get my floorboards up most evenings just to make sure they were all in place. Because if you lost any, you couldn't get replacements. You see, all metal was used for armaments. Never mind boats and nuts and bolts. And so I used to check the couplings every evening when we finished work. And then at the back end, there was where the shafting went through the actual hull, the back end. There was what we called the grease tap, and you had to keep it filled with grease. Otherwise you'd get drips. It was filled with this tow, this yellow tow, and you would get drips coming from the aperture where the shafting went. You can understand that there would be just a slight crack where the shafting was turning. And if you didn't keep that watch. Anyway, I can remember one time when I had that first boat, the Hercules, which was a dreadful boat, always never been serviced and so forth, and drip, 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 and I could not get it to stop, and I called, there was a boatman said nearby, and he offered to help, and he said, I couldn't turn the grease cap to get the grease going down onto the shafting, and he said it had seized up. He said, you get that fixed. And he was very good. And he packed it and did something which stopped this endless drip, but only for a time. And so, of course, a bucket of coal was ready as a recompense. And he was very grateful because he said they hadn't got much on board. So coal was an extremely valuable commodity cargo.
Seem from what you're saying, Margaret, that it was very difficult with your spares, even nuts and bolts. I imagine the windlass.
If you lost a windlass, you never got another one. It was your most valued possession. Sometimes, the lock keepers were all important in this scenario. When a lock was sometimes dredged for repairs, either to a boat or to lock gates, and the odd windlass that had been dropped would be salvaged by the lock keeper. And invariably, they had one or two spares, but only at a price. And if they liked you, I never lost mine. I was very careful. In fact, my old windlass, I'd just given to Kevin, who runs the Hyperion, my old motorboat, and I gave him my windlass, which I've had until very recently. And I thought, well, I should be dead soon, so he might as well have it and keep it with the boat.
That was your original, was it? Your original one?
Yes, yes.
It
was a good weapon, you see. It was useful not only for turning lock keys, but for fishing. It was a bent piece of iron which you could use for fishing things out of water, and it was a very good weapon, actually. I used to, when I lived in Ireland, which I did after, after I left the canals, and it was a bit dicey. We had IRA and a few other sort of happenings around where I was, so I thought, well, I've got my windlass. If anybody attacks me, they'll get it. I know how to swing a windlass.
Could I ask you about the various tasks on the boat? Because I imagine you had to be skilled at several of these. Did you steering and
steering and using the right techniques for towing? If you were going round bad bends like Lady Capel's bends, you had to use the motor's strength to pull round the bows of the butty. Therefore, you needed to be on a medium strap, which you would shorten. If you were on the motor, you were a very busy person. Not only were you steering and changing gear, because we had gear, you know, changing speeds, but you had the towing rope was attached to the dolly at the back end of the counter, which was the deck of the motorboat, and you would have to be very nippy to you'd take the half hitch or double hitch ready to loose off and to lengthen the towing rope where it was necessary. Obviously from the bow, it was fixed at the other end to the bows of the butty. Well, you know, there was nobody on the bows of the butty, so the motor person on the motor had all this to do to control the length of the towing line according to the needs, and to watch for the butty as much as for the motor. And to be, you know, conversant with what the person on the butty was doing or not doing, and signals and. It used to go on quite considerably. But when we got used to working as a team, we knew it became automatic, you know, we worked very well. And, of course, there was also engine maintenance. You had to look after your own engine. They were water-cooled national engines fed by diesel. We used to take in diesel at Hawkesbury and at Southall. I forget how many gallons, but there were two enormous tanks, triangular tanks set into the wall of the engine room. The engine was started not by a marvellous electric switch. You had to swing an enormous flywheel. It took two of us and on the flywheel to swing it, and a third person ready to push over the ignition so that it would fire. And you were lucky if it fired, and you kept it going so that you didn't have to do it all over again. And I can remember you'd start swinging slowly and you'd work up speed, and then you'd gradually get one, two, three, oh! And then pull on the accelerator, the governor rod, as it was called, the accelerator cable, to get the number of revs up, you know, to keep it going. Of course, they varied these engines. The first, as I said, the Hercules was a dreadful engine. It fell apart in the end. But I took over Hyperion. That was a super engine.
What would have happened, Margaret, if you couldn't get your engine to go and you had to contact somebody? I imagine this was before the days of mobile phones.
Indeed, indeed. It was either by a passing boat. I had a list of the phones that were accessible, reasonably accessible, but of course you were never near one in order to phone up. And in any case, there were very few fitters. They'd all been called out. There was George, the fitter from what's the name of the place? Not Hawkesbury. Dear. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Tring. And there was another George, but they were kept so busy. I mean, when the Hercules finally packed up at the top of Napton Locks, it was all in pieces on there. George had it all in pieces on the bank, and he said it was quite impossible. He couldn't put it together again. He didn't have the necessary replacements. So actually, that was when I took over Hyperion, because Christian Vlasto, another of the trainees, she had left the boats, and I was able to take over her boat, which was an excellent motor. But you had to do all the maintenance. You had to make sure that the pumps were working. They were cylindrical things. They always reminded me of the shells from the First World War. They were that shape. And the slightest bit of grit, coal dust, you had to make sure that they were clean. And you would unscrew the top half, and with a stick or a piece of metal with a blob of grease on the end, and you would lower it to abstract any of the bits that might be making this thing stick. And then you watched, another job when you were on the motor steering, you watched the outlet for the bilges. Because if that wasn't pouring, then you were in trouble. The bilges would fill up, and the flywheel would get busy spattering the whole of the engine room with this oily muck. It happened once, and only once. I forget. I don't know whether it was I on the motor. But no, it wasn't. Helen was on the motor, and she hadn't watched. And I should have watched from the butty, and I hadn't. And the next thing we knew... coming out of the engine room doors was this flurry of oily water. I know Virginia offered to go down and clean up. She put an awful rag over her head, I don't know where she got it from, and went down and cleaned it up. It was awful. So you watched, you had to watch for that. You had to clean the pumps to make sure that there were no pieces of grit to stop them functioning. You also had to clean the intake from the canal, because they were water cooled. And the mud box was a filthy job, and that had to be cleaned out every trip to make sure that the water intake was pure enough not to clog up the machinery. They're incredible when I think about it. And keeping your engine room clean. You see, the boat people, we always longed to gain their approbation. they were amazing how they, immaculate engines. All the brass rods were always cleaned and shining. And you keep, if you've done your engine room and had your own brass rods shining, you keep the engine room doors open for everybody to see. I must have another drink.
Were they your sort of model? Did you aim to reach their standards?
Oh, very much so. We longed for their approval. We depended on their approval because they would help us in problems, in trouble. And we admired them so. We did admire them, their expertise, the way the women coped with children in these terribly small confines. Most of them immaculate, most of them, of course there were the few, as there always are. You see, again, most of them, that's why, partly why I wrote the book, because I felt all this wonderful expertise would be lost. Because they had very little education. You see, they were always on the move. There was a school in a converted boat at Southall, that's at the depot, where they might spend a day or two, you know, between waiting for orders, and the children would be going to the school. But very, very little. Most of them were unable to read. I mean, Sonia married George, and he couldn't read all right. And most of them couldn't. I knew Lil Smith, and she had spent, two or three years with grandparents at Braunston, on land, and she had been to school in Braunston, and I could remember she invited me into her mum's, that was the daughter, into her mum's cabin, Mrs. Smith, at Christmas time, and she read a bit of the Christmas Carol. I thought it was wonderful, because so many couldn't, and yet the women knew to a T how much they were owed. They knew they could count the money. They knew exactly what they were owed. I think Kit, and maybe Sonia too, found that a certain Mr. Somebody in the office had been swindling the payments for the loads for some of the boat people. And they had discovered, you know, I think they uncovered it. I think there was a bit of a row about it. But the women were very, very keen on it. They knew. And it kept the children. You see, the only way, I mean, they had their children born on the boats. People died on the boats. And to get to Braunston, where Sister Mary, she was an unofficial nurse. I don't think she was ever qualified, but she was regarded with the greatest of love and admiration by all the boat people. She would cure anything. If they could only get to Braunston, she'd lay them out, she'd birth their children, and she always had a box. When I slipped off a lock side in the lower road and damaged my knee badly, and I had to call if I can get Sister Mary. Actually, I had to take a few weeks off because I'd sprained collateral ligaments. But however, I remember going into her sitting room was fitted out as a dispensary, covered in white sheets. She herself dressed all in white. And she had a box, and she was an amazing person. She had a box, and you always made contributions, and that was for the boat people. Because she never charged them. They hadn't any money. This was an act of love. I always used to think, compare her with Mother Teresa. Yes, I used to think she was another Mother Teresa. Her house is still there, of course, at the top of Braunston. Yes, you can still see it where she lived. I pay a pilgrimage every now and again to Braunston.
Do you have any idea what the boat people thought of you when you first started going on the canals? You know, were you regarded
very oddly? Of course, we wore trousers, and they didn't. They wore long black skirts. Incredibly nimble and agile, and those skirts. When I think about it,
did you seem a threat to them, though?
I think they thought we were after their men. What men there were left. There weren't many left. We were taking the place of men. They didn't quite know what to make of us. I mean, I can remember one of them said to me, she said, "You don't know the half of it." She said, "You've got no kids and you've got no man to look after. All you've got is the boat work." She said, "That's easy." And it's true, you see. We have all the problems of children and looking after them. Safety, for God's sakes. The only babies used to be sat on the cabin top, tied to the chimney to stop them falling overboard. There were still accidents, of course. A baby who fell over, I don't know, probably fell overboard and was squashed between the lock side and the boat. You see, that was a difficulty. It wasn't just falling overboard and not swimming. The boat could close in on you, and they were big, heavy iron hulls, steel hulls, heavy. I mean, disastrous things. That's what did my leg. I mean, it wasn't the fact that it was in the lower road, and it was when I was on training boats with Daphne, and they were single locks. So you took on one boat, the motorboat went on ahead and took itself down through the locks, and you had to bow haul, pull the butty boat through the locks. And the people on the motorboat, when they went through, these were downhill locks. No, were they? I can't remember. No, it must have been an uphill lock. And they would draw a paddle to leave the lock filled for the second boat to come along. So all you had to do was to open the gate and pull the butty inside. And I was on the cinder path, a filthy old place it was, with a terrible great rope wound round me, dragging this butty along. wasn't so much hard work because the butty would go of its own momentum once started. It was Elsie on the tiller, that's right. And it was in my early days. And I was on the towpath and coming up to the lock, which looked to be full. All it needed was to open the gate, and I'd gone ahead, with the leaving the butty to keep on its own way. And the gate I couldn't open the gate, it wouldn't budge. And I whipped up a paddle, it still wouldn't budge. And there was the butty coming, heading for it. Now, it was a terrible crime to crash the locked gates, because, of course, repairs were minimal. And I'd had the old training on the return, the boat first, because we couldn't afford repairs. And I did the most stupid thing. I got onto the ledge of the locked gate to try and stop this great heavy, it was an empty boat, true. Even so, they're lethal. They're a great heavy 70-footer heading straight for me. Luckily, it missed. I just grazed and I slipped and grazed. The bows just caught my leg and twisted it, and I did have these sprained collateral ligaments, and I was laid up for the rest of that trip. Of all the stupid things to have done. But of course, I'd been trained boat first. And Daphne said, never, those boats can take it, you can't.
Did you ever fall in the water?
I did, again, on the that first trip with Bash and Mary. We were tying up, again, a stupid thing, which I should have known. Just remember where we were. I can remember the scene. There were warehouses and a towpath, and I suppose it was on our way down to Limehouse. And what happened? I was caught between trying to get onto the towpath side, and the boat was going in the other direction. I fell in between the two, of course. A stupid thing to have done. I mean, one always knows you don't jump from a boat that's not tied up. I'd done it on the return, I should have known. And I went in. Bash was delighted. She's gone in. And you can't get out, you see, because it was a very smooth coping, stone coping. And I was grovelling in this oily, mucky water. And I did, I think, finally find a toehold. I had plimsoll shoes. I can remember plimsolls. I was glad I did, because I was able to grab a toehold and eventually to heave myself out. And you always, the engine room was a wonderful sort of place in which to dry off, because it was warm. So it was into the engine room, strip off and hang up everything. And I didn't even have any spare clothes. It was that first trip, because I was very poorly clothed. I think of my only good pullover and good mac or something. And Daphne lent me one of her pullovers and handed me in some bits and pieces. But, yes, that was the only time I ever did go in. But still on the training boats, and again, to revert back to that very bad winter when we had ice, and we had these two poor lasses, their first trip on board, and before we got iced up, we were having to break the ice before we started off in the mornings, and I think it was up towards Hatton. Oh, Knowl. No, it was Knowl Locks, Knowle. That's right, because they're quite deep and quite wide. They're quite fearsome locks. And I don't know how the boats were breasted up. Were they breasted up? Anyway, Daphne was on the motor, and they were singled out. The boats were singled out. And she had one of the trainees with her. And she stood on the boats had a narrow decking of about 3-4 inches in which you used to perch by the side of the person who was steering the guide. And she stood on this coping and slipped, and she was in. And with all her heavy, and it was cold, so she had a heavy coat on, waterlogged, you know. Couldn't get her out at all. And the motor, I shouted from the butty. I couldn't, I dared not go along the top planks because they were icy. I couldn't reach her. So I shouted, go into neutral, turn the engine off, because you could get caught in the blades. The clothes could get caught in the blades. So I shouted, turn the engine off. Luckily, the girl responded and turned the engine off. And then I said, shaft away, because the back end of the boat was closing in on Daphne to squash her between the coping and the boat. So I was shouting instructions to get, and she herself was shouting in fear and fright, you know. Daphne couldn't get out. She was like a landed seal there. Luckily for us, there was a lock keeper who heard our shouts and came down and, of course, hauled Daphne out, and very frightened, and he himself was quite, Miss French, she never goes in, you know. Miss French was held in great respect by all the lock keepers. She was such a good boatwoman and very pleasant, and always had a supply of cigarettes, of course, to hand out. And again, into the engine room and strip off and so on. And he helped us up through. It was at Noel. He helped us up. We went into the Black Boy pub at the top, and we all had a much-needed drink of rum, I think it was, to recover. Yes, that was quite a frightening experience because it was so slippery. You didn't realise, you didn't see it. You know, ice doesn't necessarily evince itself on the stone. And I couldn't get from the I was on the butty, I remember, because I thought, dare I risk going along those top planks to reach the fore end in order to help? But I didn't dare, because I would have gone in as well. And that was quite a frightening experience. But after that that was one bad winter. I don't remember any other time that we were so badly marooned. The winds were very difficult with empty boats and high up out of the water. There were times when you could not steer the boats. They were blown in on the bank and you couldn't get it off with all the shoving and heaving. You could not get them off, and there was nothing for it. You'd have to tie up and wait till the winds died. Winds were our greatest enemy, if you like. But of course, we didn't have bad weather all the time. There were lovely days, you know, when everything went well and it was wonderful, and you thought there was no better life than this. Just sing. Yes, I like singing. And if I was left on my own on the butty, you know, I'd start singing. Yes, so we had Christmas on the boats, of course. That was when I was still with Daphne on the training boats. I can remember that we were tied up near Nuneaton. Old Griff, that's where another coaling place, which was an awful coaling place. And believe it or not, the coal was hauled on board on wheelbarrows, wheeled up planks from the bank into the hold. I mean, it was a day-long job. And it was awful coal anyway from Griff Colliery. We never liked loading at Griff. That was near Atherstone.